Welcome, everyone. Sometimes it seems as if we're bombarded by negative messages everywhere we turn. This may make it hard for us to believe that we can overcome challenges or create change in our lives. But that's where positive psychology comes in. Positive psychology focuses on how we can use our strengths to thrive even under the most challenging circumstances. My guest today, Lisa Cypers Kamen, is an applied positive psychology and lifestyle management consultant specializing in sustainable happiness, integrated well-being, mindfulness, and life crisis triage. Lisa is here to help explain and talk to us about her work and what positive psychology is, provide tips, tools, how we can incorporate that in our lives, and really just share what it is to reframe our thoughts. Lisa, welcome to the show. I'm so happy to have you with us.
Oh, Eric, I'm just so thrilled to be here with you. This is great.
I met you many years ago, and something resonated the minute I met you, and the minute you spoke, and your energy in itself is just of light and truth and beauty, and I really, really, you know, understood what you were talking about, because for me in my own, you know, experience with my own life and the things that I've recovered from, positive psychology and changing the way my thoughts were processing was the key for me, the key to unlock a really fulfilling and meaningful life. So can you tell me how you got into this? And for the audience that's never heard what positive psychology is, what that is?
Well, you know, the short version is positive psychology is a science of happiness, but it's not happiness with the annoying yellow smiley face. It's really about those things that make our lives have meaning. You know, it's how we feel in our lives, how we're living and occupying our lives. And if we can help people have a better perception, perspective, and execution of our daily lives, people will enjoy themselves more. They'll report better health. They'll report minimization of depression, some of the symptoms of craving when in addiction recovery.
Yeah. And what about for the people that just say, you know, because I meet people like this all day that have been in, you know, a dark period of their lives and say, listen, I hear you telling me to reframe, you know, I just can't stop the negative self-talk or the chatter in my head. They're always mind reading. They're always assuming about the worst for people. How do we get them to see that you can recreate a pathway? I mean, I truly believe in rewiring your brain, but how do you get somebody that's in a place of really a place of hopelessness to see that? Or how do
this
we start someone like that? Yeah.
Well, this is a great question, because I like to backstep a little bit and ask people to consider the uses of the darkness. You know, when things in our lives are not going well, when we are experiencing depression, hopelessness, darkness, even the dark nights of the soul, really at rock bottom, part of the process in my mind of beginning to reframe that is really asking, what is this telling me about my life, and how can I use it as a catalyst for change? So it's not minimizing the darkness, it's actually shape-shifting it.
I love that. How can I use that as a catalyst to change? Yeah, that's
it's telling
really
us something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. And but for also those people that are listening now that say, you know, I'm aware. I hear my own talk in my head. I look at a happy couple to the right, and I say to myself, you know, I'll never get that. Or I see a job, and I'll never be able to do that. I mean, you know, we're dealing with a lot of people that have had a series of kind of disappointments. So how do we get people to see that we really can begin to use things like affirmations and setting intentions and certain things like that, that will, I think, start to kind of lay down the foundation for those kind of hopefully positive messages to come up eventually.
Well, setting intentions and affirmations are great tools. You know, they're the beginning place, but somebody who is experiencing stuckness or darkness or the absence of hope and light in their lives, which is extremely painful, you know, to feel that there is a sense of hopelessness and there's no belief or optimism for a better tomorrow. So this is a great place to start. But in addition to the intention and the affirmation, it requires, and this is the coaching aspect, and this is where coaching and therapy really do separate, that in coaching, we're asking clients to commit to action steps. What are we willing to do to create shift? And that it comes from less thinking and more doing.
I totally echo that, and I am all for action too. I really feel like a lot of people finally get that contrast that they need to see themselves in a different light. You know, when they haven't seen themselves as successful or powerful or responsible, how are you going to see that if you're just thinking about things? You have to take action, right? Is that something you work on with clients a lot?
Completely. It's based upon, you know, it's attention, intention, and then action. You know, once we focus in on where we want to go, then we really talk about, you know, the goal. Then what are we willing to do to achieve it? And that is often a component that's left out of the process because it leaves us in wishing for something more. And the wishing doesn't get us there. It's the doing that gets us there.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the being, you know, which is something that we as Westerners, the Western world has a very hard time with, to be able to just be with what is. And then the paradox is in the being, finding those action steps that allow us to occupy our lives more comfortably.
Yeah, I love that. And so I know that you obviously do many, many things. You're an author, a filmmaker, a coach. You have a company that helps and consults. What do you think that, you know, what do you see the most, I would say? What is it about trauma too? I know you've worked a lot with post-traumatic stress, but do you think that a lot of people are stuck because of traumatic things, even if it's, you know, on a continuum scale? I think that there's so many kinds of trauma. There's big traumas and little traumas, but do you see that as something that we have to explore?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when we look at places in our lives where we're stuck, whether it's a challenge with substance abuse, whether it's depression, whether it's anxiety, whether it's being stuck in a bad relationship or an unsatisfying career, there's some underlying motivating factor that holds us back. And I think it is essential to explore what that is. And at the same time, in the processing part of it, the psychotherapeutic part of it, it needs to be counterbalanced with the understanding that, in a certain sense, all of that is in the rearview mirror, and how can we make meaning out of what happened, albeit negative events, right? We can't change what happened. We can only change the relationship, our relationship to those events, and again, use that as a catalyst for change and growth and transcendence.
Right. And I know that events that we've all endured have shaped us into the people we are, and sometimes even our personality to a certain degree. And I know a lot of my clients identify themselves around those traumatic events. How do we get people to see that they are not their mistake, or they're not their event, or they're not their shame, or they're not their, you know, how do we get people to see that they can move away from that? Or how do you help people do that?
Well, one of the ways that I know that works well for me and in my practice with my clients is we want to help them shift their approach to life to be more like an explorer. So if they have a set of perceptions, you know, I could never be that, or I'll never be more than that, whatever label they give themselves, you know, to challenge them with proving differently. You know, what little action step can you do and have success in achieving that then proves that there is hopefulness, that there is the possibility of something different and even better. And it can be really little, you know, like someone says, you know, I'm lazy. I can't get out of bed, you know, every day. I'm up at noon. Well, you challenge them to do better. Maybe it's 11:30, then it's 11, then it's, you know, then it's 10:30, then it's 10. And you sort of dial it back a little bit at a time so they have measurable, achievable goals that say, you know, I can be a success, even though it's a tiny little thing. It then allows them to stretch their curiosity to go further.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I really truly think that people respond better to small goals like that and to little actions. And then obviously I think, congratulating yourself and being your own best friend or being self-compassionate, I think comes into play here, doesn't it? If we're kind of trying to change our, self-chatter in a sense into something more positive. I always felt like that, once I did something that I was proud of, whether it was making my bed or taking a shower, or taking a run or whatever, to say, good job, you got this, you're strong, whatever it is. It sounds silly, but I feel like it does really start to help create these pathways in our brains that allow the next best thing to come or the next good decision to be made. What you eat, if you exercise, you're going to eat something better. And I think all of this stuff, mind, body, and spirit, right, it's all connected. So how do you talk about this a lot in your work?
Absolutely.
And your clients? Yeah.
Yes. It has to be a multi-pronged approach, to work with somebody on the mind, the body, the spirit, and the emotions. And you mentioned self-compassion, and I would even add something I think that goes even a little bit deeper than just being compassionate, merciful.
Yeah.
To have self-mercy.
Yes. Yes, for sure. Yes. And forgiveness, with mercy, you said that. And I just thought of the forgiveness.
Yeah.
I'm always talking to clients, even recently, that just can't seem to forgive themselves for their trauma. And even if it wasn't caused by them, it's still very hard for them to shake their part in it. Even if they were the victim. And I know that you with post-traumatic stress disorder, you work with veterans, and you've done a lot of work. We can get into harvesting happiness for heroes in a moment. But post-traumatic growth, you talk about. And
yes.
I love that term. I think it's so powerful. And can you explain what post-traumatic growth is and how we can move away from the stress of the trauma to the growth?
Yes, absolutely. And there is a seminal psychology book that is read in a lot of universities around the world, and that is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And in that book, he talks about surviving the Holocaust and concentration camps, and the component or the series of character strengths that were possessed by those that were able to survive and move forward. And really, the essence of that is meaning making. How can we create meaning out of these horrible things that have happened in our lives? And by the way, we all have it. All of us will have some level of trauma. And you talk about rewired and the theme of your book and your show and your work. It's how we change that relationship, to what has happened through repetitive action, because that's how you repair and move forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's something that I think, we sometimes, if we're not taught that we don't see that. And that's another thing, is that sometimes what we're used to and the way we grew up and the cycles and patterns that we've seen in our families repeat themselves. So it is really great to get out there and read these books and talk to a coach like yourself and to explore this world of goodness and wellness and positive psychology and shifting your mindset, because I think mentally everything is up there. That will unlock a whole new world.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. It's like the human dashboard. And if we can get control of our own dashboard, we really have control over the only thing that we ever possibly could control in our lives, and that is our minds and ourselves. I want to just mention one thing about trauma, Eric. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but about
how
the brain processes trauma, because the brain doesn't really know the difference between the kinds of trauma. If a brain is stress overloaded, which in a sense, that is what post-traumatic stress is, it's the brain's exposure to extreme amounts of stress that then overload the brain, the way the brain functions, the way then it affects the body. But it doesn't calibrate. The brain doesn't understand the subtleties. And that's what the post-traumatic stress response is. So if we've had a cataclysmic trauma in our childhood, and then we're in adulthood and we have something that tweaks us, triggers us, or sets us off, the brain then processes that trauma of the present as if it were the same threat level of that past traumatic event. It has, the brain doesn't have discernment.
Hmm. Interesting. That's really good for people to know that are listening that don't, that have not really explored or been educated about trauma.
Exactly. And it's very empowering because once we understand how our brain is operating, because it's coming from a very primal part of the brain, right? Which is, you know, the kill or be killed or fight or flight or sort of caveman brain, reptilian brain. If we understand that the response is not coming from the conscious awareness, it's coming from the subconscious awareness that's embedded in us from years and years ago.
Yeah. And you know what? I was talking to another colleague about trauma recently, and it was interesting that, and I just wanted maybe your opinion on this, that sometimes when we're kids, we endure something that maybe isn't right, or maybe, you know, but we don't know whether that's right or wrong. It just may feel a little strange, or someone says something strange or touches, you know, something happens. But what he was saying was that the trauma comes sometimes from the reaction of someone else, like a parent. So that, you know, something could happen to a child and then the parent goes, oh no, and creates a fear, and the child could feel that energy, and that sometimes that's what actually plants that seed of the trauma in that person's brain, or the reaction of someone else. Is that true, do you think? Or
I do. I absolutely think and agree with that, you know, as kids, we look to our parents or the primary caregivers to establish our base safety. And if that person responds in an alarming way or overcompensates for something bad that may have happened, that imprints in our minds, but they're actually responding from their own perspective, the caregiver or the parent, that it may not necessarily be appropriate for the child, but the child's absorbing it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what,
as
that's
their
what
own.
We were just saying. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's why sometimes, you know, if any parents are listening out there, to just be mindful of that. But, you know, I mean, I'm sure there's all warranted concern if something happens. But it's just so interesting the way that we don't even sometimes see how our behavior bleeds into our children's self-conscious in a way, or subconscious in a way. So I just find that trauma is such an interesting subject matter, and I, like you said, we all have endured something, but it's a matter of understanding it and how we can use that to propel us to, you know, to learn from it and to help others, hopefully. I think that's powerful, would you say, to help? Do you push people that have been through some kind of traumatic event to live in that truth, to speak about that truth, to help others, or do you think it's better to process that on their own?
Well, I think, you know, having the discussion is always cathartic. You know, the secret sauce of healing, it's, you know, not so secret. You know, I think it's really having these frank, open, vulnerable, courageous conversations with people that we might not necessarily feel we can trust in the beginning. You know, and I'm thinking of a group therapy session or working with a coach or working with a therapist. There's a bit of mistrust in the beginning. Like, how is this person going to help me? When the help really comes from that willingness to risk, you know, the willingness to be vulnerable and share and feel unburdened as a result of allowing that truth to come out.
Yes, absolutely. And also I think that, you know, for people that have grown up and had some kind of relationship with a substance or food or gambling or, you know, an addiction of some kind or dependency of some kind, do you try and take a different approach with people that have experienced some kind of addiction in that sense, and how that they, you know, can use that experience with the substance or with, you know, with the behavior, that can actually lead to a better life? Like, how can we help people to see that with this kind of addiction where maybe they were lying and robbing and cheating and stealing and manipulating, how all these qualities or how all these, you know, behaviors, which my clients will sit and say, I'm not a good person. How could someone good do that? And I, you know, and I try to explain the brain and how, you know, when we are hijacked by drugs or alcohol or something else, you know, we're not really in our right mind, literally. And so, you know, but people internalize that and really see that their behaviors are themselves. They identify with them. How do you approach this is my question, because it's so intricate.
It is so intricate, and it's actually part of the trauma, because what I hear you talking about is moral injury.
Yes.
You know, that when we're in the throes of active addiction, there is a moral compromise that sometimes comes about. There's the lying, there's the cheating, there's the manipulation, there is the dark side that exists within each one of us. I don't care, you know, how good we think we are. We all possess, you know, that aspect, those shadow selves that get activated in our despair.
Yeah. And I like the moral injury to look at it in that way, because trauma is, it could be something where, you know, your core values have completely left the building, and that sometimes is very devastating to people, and it's a real deep self-betrayal, even though they may not be conscious of what that is, that self-betrayal. Every morning when they wake up and they feel terrible about what they've been doing, or you know, are not obviously happy with the life they're leading. If we could identify this as, you know, our core values have been kind of hijacked in a way, and that you can get back to who you truly are with some reframing, with some positive thinking, and with obviously living a healthier lifestyle.
And also with outsourcing support. You know, if we come from a family of origin that did not provide good role modeling, we can learn it. You know, this is part of the rewiring process that you speak of. You know, we can shift. You know, the brain is plastic to a certain degree, that we can teach us old dogs the new tricks.
Yes, I agree.
It's so true.
It is so true, but it's so true, and it's so hard for people that have had decades of a certain kind of lifestyle and decades of leaning onto something outside themselves to deal with stress, to cope with life, to get by with about everything. And that's the trick, is how can you, you know, if someone says, well, every relationship has been involved with drinking, and every job, and every, you know, every emotion, when I'm sad, I drink, when I'm happy, I drink, you know, when your whole life is encompassed really by a substance, or that substance is alive in your life, it's you know, a part of it. And then you take that away, that relationship away, and you're left with really nothing. I mean, you're left with a lot, but they see it as nothing. And that positive thinking is just not there, you know? And so it is starting, I think a lot of the times it's a rebirth for people, and starting totally fresh and totally new. And sometimes it's almost better to have a clean slate. Do you see that?
I agree with you. And I think that the removal of the substance from someone's life, when someone gets to the place where, like, they're ready to do this thing differently, this journey, there needs to be attention to the grief and loss process. And it's a twofold grief and loss process. Oftentimes, it's the grief and loss over those original traumas that never got handled at the times that they occurred. And then there's the grief and loss by the removal of the substance, the death of that person, of the self. The metaphoric death that we all must go through when we let go of something that is no longer serving us. And it's often overlooked, I think, in the recovery process.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we don't look at it like a death. And I try to approach this as, you know, you may be going through stages of grief, and that, you know, you may be mourning something, and this companion, whether it was, even if it was a toxic companion, is still gone. And I think we have to look at it that way. I mean, I would love to hear your take on this too. But for me, I think abstinence is number one. I mean, that's what you have to do in order to start healing. And two, to kind of visualize visualize and try and wrap your mind around the fact that substance or that behavior is dead to you. If you know, dead, buried, had a ceremony, whatever you want to, however you want to visualize that. But you can't, from what I think, you can't really leave the door open even a little bit. You cannot keep that window cracked. If there is a possible, you know, thought that's still saying, maybe I could drink in a month from now, or a week from now, or this, or I could do, you know, or I could, you know, start gambling a year after I try and stay abstinent. Like, all those thoughts really just lead to, I think, setting yourself up for failure.
You know, what pops into my mind as you're speaking is, can you be a little pregnant?
Yeah, exactly. I love that. I love that. Thank you.
Right?
Thank you. Yeah, that is perfect. That is perfect. You cannot be a little pregnant. That's the greatest analogy. I'm going to say that now. Yeah.
I am too, because I never thought of it that way until you were speaking, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, totally, totally. Well, thank you, Lisa. This is such an insightful, important, and just all around life-changing conversation. I really appreciate you being here with me today. Can you tell everyone where they could find you?
They can find me on harvestinghappinesstalkradio.com. My show airs every week, new episodes on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific time.
Thank you so much. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you for joining us, and stay well.